Let's do it. All right. Well, we're live. Apparently, this is the first time I've done live video.
Oh, is it? So okay. I did it once before. I filmed the workout. I let people comment on it. So
cool.
But yeah. Well, cool, man. Guess we're talking in your Facebook group.
Yeah. So the RLC private Facebook group. Hi, everyone. For whoever's watching, we'll see how this works. I'm guessing I should be able to see if there's any comments or questions that come up from anyone watching this live. But if not, man, when James and I get together, we can just kind of chat and dive into some interesting topics pretty easily and pretty quickly.
So, yeah.
So yeah, man. Thanks for the ride this morning.
Yeah, man. That was a lot of fun. Thanks for getting me out. It's funny, first time I've got a chance to meet and ride in person. So
yeah,
I was glad you didn't leave me in the dust too bad there.
No, it's a good little rip. So
heck yeah, man. Well, cool. What, I guess on our ride, we were kind of talking about the jump course a little bit.
Yeah.
And, I was finding out, you know, some of the stuff that you found with that was pretty interesting. And I know we'd, we got somebody who's joining us there.
Oh, right on. Hey, Kevin.
So yeah, man, I was kind of, you know, interested in some of the stuff that you were learning. We were chatting with about the jump course and stuff, and I know I wanted to talk to you a little bit more about that, but so yeah, I know I told you I found it really interesting that you hadn't really learned to jump beforehand, and the kind of that risk to benefit ratio thing that you had to do. So I thought it was really cool that you admitted that, you know what I mean? Like, you're, you know, here you are, Ryan Leach, like mountain biking star, and like saying like, no man, like here's this skill that I'm a white belt at, and I need help, and so I'm actually gonna like my journey I'm gonna help benefit people with, I thought was pretty cool. So
yeah, and I don't want to like, yeah, I definitely still had a pretty big head start based on my experience as a mountain biker and as a trials rider, but the fear was still there, and the reluctance to learn was still there, the hesitation. So like, I definitely can relate to that, and it's a very common thing for a lot of mountain bikers who are learning to mountain bike later in life, and they want to catch some air and have that experience. Like we were saying today, it's a pretty magical feeling to be kind of floating and flying through the air on your bike.
Yeah.
And but for the bulk of my career, the cost benefit sort of ratio was not there. I could not injure myself learning to jump, because then it would prevent me from doing what I loved, which was trials riding. That was my focus.
So. Yeah. No, man. I mean, that totally makes sense. But so, again, I know I'd asked you some of the stuff earlier, but I just like to touch on it. But like, you know, so what were like some of those big takeaways, you know, that you had from the course? Or, you know, just in like learning and putting it together, like what did you take from it?
Yeah, for me, I was just always going too fast. I was hitting jumps too quickly, and that forced me to have to absorb the jump. And because I didn't have a strong, solid foundation, knowing how to deal with lips properly at a slower speed, it always shot me off course. I always kind of flailed, and I got kick sideways, and you know, obviously it's a skill to be able to absorb a jump so you can hit them faster, but if you don't know how to hit and work with a jump lip in a way that it puts you in charge of it, then you're gonna lose.
And a lot of people
lose, and it's not a good result.
No, I think you were talking about like a lot of people make that mistake of trying to ride their bike off of a jump as opposed to like being active into the jump, and like, you know, you have to do things and, you know, lead the dance, so to speak, as opposed to like letting the bike and then the jump lead the dance, and you just kind of hope things go the right way.
But
it takes some practice, because it's definitely like we were talking about, something I had to go through learning how to jump and getting those hips into it and stuff like that. So and for me, that's like where like the kettlebell swing, like those movements and stuff, you know, in the gym, I felt really helped with that. Was like, you know, if you can't, you know, move well off the bike, you're going to have trouble moving well on the bike. Yeah. And so being able to connect those things back to the gym and stuff like that. Because, if you can't drive your hips forward, like do a good deadlift, you know, where you're not using your lower back to lift. Because, you know, again, like that, the cue to get tall off of a jump, like we were talking about, there's different ways to get tall.
Yeah.
And if you get tall the wrong way, it throws you off.
Yeah. And for me, I would often get tall, but my weight would be too far rearward because I've come from a bunny hopping. I take charge by bunny hopping.
Yeah.
And that's often I was over bunny hopping, on the face, the jump, and that created me to be too far rearward, which created the need to extend the bike forward towards the landing to try to get that angle, and it just was not working. So Shams March and Jay Hoots help out with this course, and to be with them in person, you know, having their teaching cues, them watching me, and then me learning and then applying what I know about coaching and progression to the whole process really came together with a nice result for my own riding. And so
nice, it's
fun to share it.
Yeah.
But you had a good analogy with basically jumping on your feet. If you were to try to jump a gap on your feet, you got to be in charge. You got to be in charge of that process.
Yeah.
You don't just when it's a very similar thing on whether you're on your bike or on your feet. You know, you got to jump.
Yeah, that was, you know, I you know, call it carcass hucking. Like if you're gonna carcass huck yourself across that gap there, you know, like just run up to it and jump across it. Like, you know, how would you approach it? And like, you know, as explained, that was a big breakthrough for me when I realized like jumping off my bike and jumping on the bike were, you know, real similar actions, and that when I'm running up to the jump, you know, I'm spotting, you know, where do I want to plant my foot? So I'm looking at kind of like that middle top of the, you know, the takeoff, and I'm going to like try and time my jump. I want my compression from my jump to like maximize at that point. And then I'm going to look across so that I can spot my landing. Like all these things are exactly what you want to do on your bike. But the speed thing, man, that was probably the big thing for me too, is like, cause I think for a lot of us, the first thing we do is learn how to do like drops and kind of downhill style jumps.
Yeah.
And so you can just kind of ride off of them and speed your friend almost a little bit.
Yeah.
And then we try to apply that same mentality to jumping, you know, with something with a lip.
Yeah.
And speed isn't always your friend on those buggers So,
and for drop-offs, you are often absorbing the drop-off with your body.
When you do it right, like that's the thing, is like I feel like a lot of us, you know, again, one of the things we're talking about at lunch is like the ability to recognize a compensation versus optimization. And so like a lot of riders, I think in the beginning, when they're doing drops and jumps on the trail and stuff like that, a lot of it's compensation, and their compensation speed, because they don't necessarily understand the technique behind it. And so they know that if they go fast enough and whatever, they can, you know, do what they need to do. But then as you advance and you learn that technique, coming off drops, it's kind of the same thing. Like I found like with jumps, like, you know, we were talking about like how the idea with a jump is you want to hit that moment of balanced, almost like weightlessness at the apex. And that's what allows, you know, and your bike kind of follows that. And that's what allows that smooth little like arc that we see riders do. But it's a natural process, or it's a natural result of the process. It's not something that I'm forcing onto the situation.
Yes. Yeah.
And then, you know, and the same thing with drops, right? Like you come up to that edge and it's like, I want to, you know, kind of get the bike in front of me and hit that little moment of weightlessness where the process results in that, rather than me riding off of it and then jamming my front end down real aggressively, which is just scary. And then you see the same thing jumping. People hit the jump and they'll like jam their front end down real aggressively because they think it looks like what they see the technique, but
and you'll lose connection with the bike quickly if that's where kind of the bowl theory kind of conversation goes in. It's pretty easy to lose that if you're in the air and you make a sudden movement. the bike's going to kind of move away from you. I mean, you see that with pro dirt jumpers. If things are going wrong, then they do that abrupt motion to get away from the bike. And you don't want to, you don't want that to happen sort of spontaneously when you're trying to actually land.
Yeah.
You
know?
So that's why learning in a progressive way is,
yeah,
is
yeah.
really important.
Yeah.
But it's cool to see a few comments coming up here. And
we got Andy is there. It's our brother that we met on the trail.
Oh, no way.
After he
cool.
broke his spoke, man. Hopefully right he got that bad boy fixed.
And I know we're going to, James and I, we can chat, like I said, for quite a long time. So if you're not able to, you know, stay and watch this video, please just leave a question. You can always come back and review this video a little later, and we'll try to get to the questions that are coming up live, and also the questions that some of you left last night when I mentioned I was going to be meeting up with James. So
cool. It looks like we got a question.
Yeah, from Kai. Yeah. Hey Kai. Yeah, it's good to see you chiming in here. Hi Ryan and James, I've just downloaded James's podcast, looking forward to listening to it. And do you deadlift with the dumbbell or weights on the bar? And yeah, you were talking about getting back into deadlifts today.
I was, man. Yeah, I've kind of redoubled my or rededicated myself to barbell deadlifts. I mean, you know, either one's fine, like dumbbells or barbell is fine. It really just kind of depends on what I don't know. I once heard one of my favorite strength coaches of all time, he would say, like, man, you give me the athlete and the equipment and I will, you know, get what I need done. So yeah. Like, if you give me a dumbbell, I will maximize that dumbbell. Right.
Yeah.
So, but you know, generally speaking, I like to use the dumbbells for like the single leg, stuff, the unilateral, movements. And then the barbell, is good for the bilateral, deadlifts. And so, just kind of generally speaking, because I've done single legs with barbells and I've done double legs with dumbbells. So it, works both ways. But, usually I kind of look at it like, you know, there's a systemic response that your body gets from just being under load. Right. And so like deadlifting 250 pounds, just put your body under this tension level. And there's a systemic response. The whole body gets this adaptation from that amount of tension and load being placed on it that you're not going to quite get from, you know, lighter weights necessarily, but you'll break your body down if you're just constantly hammering yourself with these heavy loads.
Right.
And so that's how you balance it. And so it's like, usually I'll try to, like once a week have like a heavy deadlift day where I'll you know, do the bilateral deadlift and I'll try and work up. And then, but I try to do the hip hinge, the deadlift movement every time I train, you know? So there's that, Dan Gable, who's a real famous, Olympic wrestler. He once like won against the Soviets back when the Soviets were like the juicing machine. And they didn't even score a point on him the entire Olympics, which is just phenomenal. But anyways, his work ethic was amazing. And he had this saying that if it's important, do it every day. If it's not important, don't do it at all.
Yeah.
Right. And
that's why I try to bunny hop on every single ride.
Right.
Those muscles toned and key, because a lot of trails, like as a lot of you guys know, a lot of trails don't necessarily require you to bunny hop. So it's easy to not continue that conditioning that you need. But every trail pretty much can benefit from the bunny hop skill, you know, just through added fun or some creative line choice.
Yeah.
So whether you're on the bike, making sure you go through some certain skills or movements, even when you might not need to, just to remind the body.
Yeah.
And same with the workout, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. If you need to hinge, you know, yeah. And so like every workout, so like, you know, some workouts that are lighter, I'll focus more on the unilateral stuff, where I'll use more kettlebells and dumbbells and stuff. So it just kind of depends on what my goal is for that day. Mm-hmm. And just trying to balance, like, you know, there's basically three, you got hard, moderate, and light workouts. Like that's, you know, and same thing with rides too. Like that's one of the big mistakes that people make with training and riding is they think that everything's hard. Well, no, hard's relative to something else. Like if you think everything's hard, nothing's hard. It's all just kind of moderate and you just don't realize it because you've never really done anything else. You know what I mean? It can't always be hard. If you're riding, you know what I mean? If you're riding 4 days a week, it's physically impossible for every one of those to be truly hard. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're lifting 3-4 days a week, it's truly, you can't have every day be hard. And so learn how to cycle your intensity levels. You know, so you have a hard day, but you know, after I have a hard day, I'm going to have a moderate day or a light day.
Yeah.
And I'm going to have a couple of those before I have another hard day to help me recover. Yeah. And same thing with riding, man. Like that's the big mistake I see a lot of riders make, man. Like people talk about cardio training for mountain biking. And I think like a lot of people are looking for cardio training programs because they're not making good use of their trail riding time. Right, like they look at their trail riding time and cardio training as these two separate things. When you're trail riding, is the most specific cardio training you can possibly do as a mountain biker. Like that's it. That is the most specific cardio training you can do.
Yeah.
And so, you know, but they go out and I'm like, okay, so you're an enduro racer or whatever, or downhill racer. I'm like, so what are your training rides look like? Well, I go out and I ride hard for 2 hours. And I'm like, is that like what your race is like? No, you know what I mean. So it's like, you don't ride like you race. Like, so like, you know, if you're a racer, your hard rides should mimic your racing. You mm-hmm. know what I mean? So if you're an enduro racer, that would entail like, you know, 30 minute easy spins with a 10, 15 minute freaking hard as you can go.
Yeah.
And then repeat.
This is the danger of Strava too, kind of puts you in that always hard kind of.
Right. Yeah. So, but that's like, and then like your moderate rides are just, and those are to me, I like to use like skill focused rides or moderate rides. Like we're talking about on PBR, how like once you get started at the top, you know, if you really work it right and conditions are right, you can get from top to bottom without ever pedaling. Mm-hmm. And so, and though to me, like that kind of mentality is like the epitome of a moderate level ride.
Yeah.
Where I'm not trying to pedal as hard as I can. I'm trying to be as smooth and efficient as I can. So I'm really focusing on my skills and efficiency as opposed to like working hard. And then you got your light days, which really is hard on a bike to do. That's where things like yoga come in, like restorative things for riders. And so but people don't get that balance. You know, it's understanding how to like, okay, I got maybe like, and it's the thing too, like I've worked with a lot of pros and I can tell you from experience, like, man, most people can get maybe 2 hard rides in a week, like legitimately hard rides a week. Your body just can't recover for more than that.
Yeah.
Like if you're a professional athlete who has nothing to do with recover and you're genetically gifted and all this stuff, maybe you can squeeze 3, mm-hmm. but I can't say you're going to benefit from it. So for most riders, you know, most average riders, you're looking at like maybe 1 hard ride a week.
Yeah.
Maybe 1 every 10 days.
Yeah.
You know? And so the bulk of your rides should be moderate, kind of these skill focused rides, you know, mm-hmm. with like these hard rides in there to test yourself and so.
And that said, it can be easy to over on skill, even if it's not a skill focused ride, maybe it's just a skill focused session, which is obviously something we really emphasize in the skill courses on the site, is it's easy to overgo doing a bunny hop practice training session like every day to improve your bunny hops is could easily and quickly lead to injury because it's such a dynamic and an intense move, and so that can lead to shoulder issues, which is some of the questions yesterday on the site they were curious about. Kind of preventing shoulder issues and preventing, and then also the lower back pain as well, which is common, not just from, you know, skill training and bunny hopping, but just from riding and having those hard rides. So probably the one answer I obviously, which you're speaking to, is just going too hard, too often all the time. So that's one sort of key thing.
But,
I don't know. Is there anything else you can say about, just the comp is so common for shoulder. I know you can say you could just spend hours talking about
that. Well, it's just funny because like the next thing, like Indian clubs and maces are really good with that. Like I was kind of, you know, showing you that a little bit.
Yeah, we got to go to your garage again. Yeah,
talk about that a little bit more. But I really like those have been great. Actually, I can close this door real quick. I forgot to close the office door. Sorry, guys. This is the benefit of live. Live stuff.
And anyone who's just tuning in here, just jot any questions you've got. Kai's already asked a question. Andy gave us an update. guy who we saw on the trail today. He's been a member for a while. So jot any comments or questions you have down, and we can see them real time here. And, you know, while we've got James here live, he's a wealth of knowledge and info. So just fire away.
So, all right, shoulders with, like the main thing that, I guess there's two things. One is like understanding like the relationship between grip strength and shoulder health.
Yeah.
And so, and that, again, that's where kind of those Indian clubs and maces that I was talking about in, because they're so grip intensive.
Yeah.
And so like to hold one of those just requires everything to be solid.
Yeah.
You know, and so, so I found like my shoulders, that actually, shoulder and neck, like I'd get like neck issues and stuff just from like sitting at the computer and climb, you know, driving. And then, you know, we're in a sport where we're like looking up, you know, and
our hands are locked in the one position too, instead of being able to work those shoulders.
Yeah, and able to move and stuff. And so, you know, I started to get some like chronic neck and shoulder. I had a pinched nerve in my neck, man, that flared up real bad. And like, you know, that was like, you know, up for a couple of nights with it bugging me. And so that's what led me on the road to getting into the maces and the Indian clubs. Just the stuff that I was reading about it and what they were for was a lot of the things that, you know, it forces good postural alignment, good shoulder stability, good grip strength, and all these things. And so I got into it mainly because to help with my neck and my shoulders, and just found that, man, it transferred over to just so many different things for me. My shoulders feel so much better. I was telling you earlier, like, man, I've separated both AC joints from crashing. Man, I've jacked myself up like so many different. I've had to joke around. I've sacrificed many body parts to the mountain biking gods, and some of them more than once, you know.
Yeah.
So it's so that's been really helpful, man. The Indian clubs and the maces have been a really great training tool to help with that. Besides that, like really, the main thing is just being aware of posture in general. And I think again, this is where something like you know, things like yoga are great because they help build the body awareness that you want to be able to apply to the bike.
Yeah.
And so if you get on the bike and you don't really understand what good posture feels like you've never spent intentional time working on what is good posture, what does it feel like, you're never going to be able to apply it to the bike. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the main cue that I try to help riders with is keeping your shoulder blades tucked into your back pockets.
Yeah.
Like if you got the tips of your shoulder blades, the bottom of your shoulder blades, and you feel like you're tucking them into into your back pockets, it's a pretty good way to keep your shoulders in a strong position. You want wide collarbones, and there we are on the thing. So don't want my collarbones, and so I'm looking for this wide collarbone, and so it's not puffing my chest out. This is another thing, like it's not this. Right? Because now my collarbones aren't as wide as they can get. They've actually shrunk a little bit, right? Like for me to get my shoulders and my collarbones as wide as possible, there's this middle ground. And that's where like tucking my shoulder blades into my back pockets come in, as opposed to puff my chest out. Mm-hmm. So I call some of these cues like ballpark cues. I'll throw at people to get them in the ballpark. So if someone's like this, you know, they're really hunched over, I'll say puff your chest out. But I'm only telling them that to get them into the ballpark. Once I get them into the ballpark, I start coaching them to tuck their shoulder blades. Because if you keep puffing your chest out, you're going to go too far. Yeah. And you're going to like, now now we're going the other direction, which isn't what we want. And so so that idea of like tucking the shoulder blades into the back pocket really helps reinforce that the wide shoulders that we're really looking for and that strong upper back. But it's, you know, it's when you're doing those movements, like you're practicing your manuals or your bunny hops, and you go into that where you're pushing the bike in front of you. And if as you push, you know, your shoulder blades are disengaging, they're coming out of your back pocket. Now your shoulders are in a bad spot. You're putting more stress on the AC joint, you know, all these things. So that can cause a lot of the shoulder issues is just simply people not keeping their shoulders packed. Like that's a term in strength training, is keeping your shoulders packed. And it's basically, it's like keeping them in this, your shoulders, cause they're so mobile, the downside is that, that they're easily open to injury. There's a very, you know, in this position here, they're pretty strong and stable, but they start getting out of this position much and they start really getting open to injury.
Sure.
And so it's keeping those shoulders in that strong position. But for me, probably the best exercises that help with that are your simple push-up, your basic push-up. And again, but it's really focusing on that upper body position, keeping those shoulder blades tucked, keeping, you know, the collarbones wide. It's not banging out 25 push-ups.
It's tough to get out of that mindset.
It is.
When anyone drops into a push-up position, I feel it. The goal is how many push-ups can I do?
Yeah.
Just like wheelies, how many pedal strokes can I do? But it's not about the quantity.
No. Yeah. No, man, I still was thinking about it this morning, man.
It's a side effect.
Yeah. I haven't done more than 10 reps of push-ups in a set in like, I don't know how long. Like, I usually don't do more than 10 because I find that if I'm doing more than 10, I'm doing some of them because they stand between me and that number. And I'm right. not focused on them.
Yeah.
And if I need to do more, like, I'll pick a harder variation. I'll put a pause in there. I'll put more focus on something. Like, I'll find a way to make those 10 reps harder.
Yeah.
As opposed to, like, just, you know, try and use the reps as a way to make it harder. And so...
That's cool to hear. That's actually really cool to hear that James Wilson doesn't generally go past 10 push-ups. And that's actually a pretty cool challenge. Can you work and be curious enough about your positioning?
Yeah. Oh, I'm worn out at the end of those 10.
Yeah.
And then every once in a while, I'll get into a class. Like when we do jiu-jitsu, we'll have, you know, somebody during warm-ups. They'll be like, okay, we're going to do 20 push-ups. You know, it's like, I can bang out 20 push-ups. And I can do them better than the other people around me. I don't have to do 20 push-ups to be able to do 20 push-ups because my 10 push-ups are so efficient and so just like rock solid that it's easy for me to extend that efficiency past that point. Whereas like if I'm focusing on 20 push-ups but I'm very inefficient in doing it, it's really hard for me to scale that efficiency any further. So it's really easy to scale efficiency. It's really hard to scale specific endurance. You know what I mean? So like me doing 20 push-ups is building the specific endurance to do 20 push-ups. Me building efficiency with 10, I can scale that efficiency. You know, I can make my 5 that scales down to 5 that scales up to 20. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so that same efficiency, that same movement is what I'm going to use for all of them. So... That's
the great transition to flat pedals. I know a lot of people are curious about flat pedals, and efficiency is what it's all about. And you know, just like you can't shortcut to high numbers of reps and push-ups, you need that foundation, and that's what flat pedals provide, is that foundation of solid technique so that you can scale these techniques in the most effective and efficient way. You've got the correct body movement pattern to scale the bunny hop, to work with the corrections in the wheelie, or to start manipulating your bike and your wheels in different directions when you're out on the trail. And those foundation drills and skills and time invested in the fundamentals in mountain biking is, man, does that pay dividends? And it's really hard to tune into those without flat pedals.
Yeah.
You know, and that's one of the, you know, I think that's one of the curses of SPDs, is it's kind of shortchanged a lot of riders' fundamental skill development. So
yeah, no, it definitely has, for sure.
And we got a few more questions going. Here. Fred Johnson, who's an awesome coach who I met in Indiana at a session, Dean Goodwell. So should we just read those out, and then we'll probably link back to this flat pedal conversation?
Yeah, that's fine.
That's so key. So
yeah,
Fred saying, James, I developed tennis elbow last year. Your shoulder exercises help get rid of it. I haven't done them in a few months and starting to feel the pain creeping back. Time for me to get back to them. Hope to see you again next summer, Ryan. Cool, Fred. Yeah. Yeah. We go through phases of training, right?
For sure.
Of cross training.
Yeah. So. Kai was asking if my neck thing, did the Indian clubs. Yeah, no, my neck's fixed 100%, man. My neck's actually never felt better. And I'm not going to say never. I'm sure when I was a kid it felt better. But it's been a long time. Like, I don't have any residual, just that nerve tingling crap, man. Like, you know, yeah. It's, and if I do get any of it, it's just, you know, a little massage or whatever and stretching and it's gone. Yeah. So yeah, I can't recommend fucking Indian clubs and maces enough. Like, I think that, you know, it's funny, man, because you look, like, if you look at the history of training, and we'll circle back to the flat pedal thing here in a second, but the, you know, Indian clubs and maces were once, like, a real big part of training, and, but what happened was, is they started to try to develop systems, and when you develop systems, you gotta, you know, develop boxes. Like, for example, most of us are familiar with, like, the old bodybuilding boxes, like biceps and triceps, right? So, like, these are boxes that you gotta check off when you're making a workout. And so you come across these tools, Indian clubs and maces, and you're like, well, what muscle group does this work? Well, it doesn't. You know what I mean? It's this real dynamic movement based thing. Well, you know, and so, well, we don't know what box these things go in, so we're just going to put them over here in the corner until, you know what I mean? And okay. So a lot of these tools kind of got forgotten. That's what happened to the kettlebell. You know what I mean? Like, one time the kettlebell was a real popular tool, and then it got, you know, was
broken in the mainstream.
Yeah, broken in the mainstream, you know, recently, but it's really just a reintroduction. Like, you can see pictures of gyms. Again, like, basketball was another, like, downfall of the American physical movement. Like, before basketball came and they cleared out all the gyms to put, you know, two hoops on either end and have nothing else in there, you can find these pictures of, like, you know, they've got clubs and they've got, you know, dumbbells and they've got bars and they, you know what I mean? Like, cool. There was a whole, like, physical culture movement that was going on. And so a lot of these training tools, they're not new. They're just a rediscovery of old training tools. But, yeah, and getting into it, I just realized that a lot of it is, you know, they didn't know where to fit these things. And so they just kind of put them in a closet and forgot about them. But these tools are paramount, man. They're so important. They're so much more effective, like, than anything else we have, you know, for a lot of different, you know, things. So I really think, man, that like the steel mace is that's the new kettlebell. Like, that's the thing that in 10 years everyone's going to be all like, you know, oh yeah, steel mace training, you know, like, yeah. You know, they know what the hell it is. And,
yeah. You
know, we're going to be looking back now going like, oh man, I remember Bike James telling me about that stuff like way back in the day. Cool. But yeah. So getting on that, it really helps. But the flat pedal thing, man. Yeah. We were talking at lunch about, like, man, honestly, the dirty little secret with clipless pedals, SPDs, is your foot can't move naturally on them, and it's not supported naturally by them.
Right.
And one of the things that the way your body works is when your foot, it relies so much on your foot for feedback, for good movement, that if you've interfered with your feet and that feedback, it's going to interfere with your movement. It's like you can't put your feet in stiff sole shoes. Like, you watch people try to, like, walk around and move in clipless pedal shoes off of the bike. Yeah. And it's gangly and weird and tough. And it's because their feet can't move and their feet are in these stiff coffins.
Yeah.
And that affects how you move on the bike as well. It's not as apparent because, mm-hmm. you know, we're in this special situation.
Mm-hmm.
But the movement's there. Like, we were talking about too, how, like, you know, proper cornering requires you to turn your feet into the pedals. You know, and if you twist your feet and you turn your feet into the pedals and SPDs, you unclip.
Mm-hmm.
So you literally have to force yourself how to learn these unnatural ways of moving in order to adapt to this unnatural platform and interface for your feet. And if you've spent the time developing your skills and learning them before that, it's easy to take these learned skills and apply it to this less optimal situation for your feet.
Right.
But if you put your foot in this less than optimal situation and then try to learn these skills,
yeah.
It's compensation city, man. That's all you're going to get out of it.
Yeah.
And that's why, like, honestly, like, you can, it's
well,
like
said,
yeah. Like, most riders' skills are crystallized in time and the day that they first put their clipless pedals on their bike. Like, most riders' skills don't develop really significantly without a shit ton of effort. You know what I mean? There's not a natural development process that you see that honestly should just come from riding your bike. If you're just putting, it's like watching a kid learn to walk, right? Like, if a kid's in just a good natural learning environment, yeah, he's going to fall over and then he's going to do better and he's going to fall over, but each thing allows him, and you see this natural progression.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't see that a lot with riders that ride clipless pedals exclusively. You don't see this just kind of like efficiency and movement progression that should come naturally on the bike. And that's why, you know, again, like, why I think you know, there's so many riders out there that are looking for the magic bullet. And, you know, the skills training industry is basically built on riders looking for an answer to their feet being trapped in these pedals. And how do I learn how to ride my bike in this less than optimal situation?
Yeah.
But anyways, I don't know. That's just my opinion.
No, that's spot on. I totally 100% agree. And I know a lot of people on the site here agree too. And, most people do tend to ride flat pedals primarily, that are going through a lot of the courses on RLC. One of the questions yesterday was, hey Ryan, what do you really think about, the Catalyst pedals? And, so I should probably address that. And for those that don't know, James developed a flat pedal that is longer. You probably have one there. And so basically it's, the longer pedal creates the, that feedback, from a much longer, place on your sole. So you can start to, use that feedback to activate, the muscles all the way up, your legs and have that as, you know, to really, I mean, I come from, you know, a lot of it is, spinning. There's the spinning benefits of that contact, of that longer contact point, that feel from your sole, but there's also the technique. And that's kind of where I'm trying to figure it out, because I've spent my entire career, with a standard pedal, and my foot kind of, I like having my toes round a bit and the back of my foot kind of round a bit. So I've grown used to that feeling, that kind of cupping, feeling over the pedal, almost like my hand is gripping the pedal. And, so with James's pedal, you can see it's, quite a bit, longer. For my foot, I can't do that sort of cupping as much with the longer pedal. And so, honestly, I haven't spent enough time to try to figure out whether I'm just so used to that sort of that toe wrap over the front, that flex of the sole over the pedal. So my job is to try to, through experience, James is setting me up with another pair of these to try on my tour. And so I'm going to try to experientially decide whether I've just adapted to the shorter pedals and that's what I'm used to and that's why I like it, or whether the longer pedal is does it just as well. And also what I'm curious about is how the longer pedal may help to reduce some of the pain I've been experiencing in my knee, you know, due to my glutes and my inner quad not firing as effectively on my rear foot, which is, you know, which is the problem. I'm not firing those muscles, which apparently is leading to some of the knee pain I'm experiencing. And so that's one of the benefits James speaks about for these longer pedals. And so I'm quite curious about this. It's funny. It just now, like, was that an infomercial or is that like, but I need to do some more experiential homework on this. So.
Now, I will say though, is that you jumped on them and spent a couple minutes on them. And there was enough curiosity from your experience on there to, spark the interest in checking out the, you know, I know we've kind of talked about what my opinion is on, you know, adaptation versus optimization and stuff. And, cause again, like, you know, it's funny, like, cause like your bowl theory, right? Like it's a perfect example, but it's like, so let's say like one end of the bowl is, you know, solid and the other end, it's not a bowl. It's like a little wire.
Mm.
You know what I mean? And I pull and I got to get that same amount of pressure. Well, my finger is going to wrap around that wire. You know what I mean? Because I'm putting so much pressure into it that it starts to create that wrap. Right? Yeah. And, but realistically, I'm going to have to create more pressure than I would without that wrap to get the same amount of lift.
Yeah.
And I can feel like that wrap is helping to lift the wire because it's getting under it a little bit. Right. And it's lifting it a little bit. Yeah. But it's not necessarily optimal. The reason that it's wrapping around that wire is because some of that pressure is inefficient. You know, it's not being efficiently transferred into what it's being pressed into, mm-hmm. right? So that's why you're getting that wrap around.
Yeah.
Whereas, like, in, you know, realistically, the most efficient way of it is if both ends of the bowl are solid.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
And so for me, like, this here is the solid end of the bowl. This is the wire.
Right. Sure.
So that's why your feet wrap around this, is because you're creating so much pressure when you're creating that bowl effect that your feet wrap. And if they feel that wrap, well, they're going to, like, you know, they're going to grab it. You know what mm-hmm. I mean? And so the your feet wrapping around the pedal aren't your feet trying to grab the pedal to hold on to it. It's your feet wrapping around it because the pressure you're creating is creating that wrap. You know what I mean? Yeah. And so there's a difference between, like, you know, your feet reaching out and grabbing the pedal because that's what it wants to do versus, like, you're pushing down so hard into that pedal that your feet wrap around that pedal.
Yeah.
And now that you have that wrap, you're able to kind of, like, find a way to use it to your advantage.
Yeah.
But it's not necessarily the most efficient use of that force and the way to use that. And so, like, that's with these pedals here, you know, you get that closed in on both ends. Now your feet and your hands are both really solid because you got your hands wrapped around the bar, so they're not going. There's no wrap there, or, you know, and then same thing here. And so now you're getting more like a deadlift where you're really wedging yourself between your pedals and your hands.
Yeah.
And you're really able to maximize that pressure between your hands and your feet.
So the theory, to me, the theory makes sense. So now I just have to, my training for a long time of riding. Now I've got to test that, this theory more experientially and try to so that'll be my homework. I'll report back.
And that's what I said I like about you, man, is you're willing to do that, whereas, like, a lot of people aren't. And you know, we were joking around earlier, it's like, man, you gotta try things, even if it's just so you can say, yeah, I tried that and it still sucks.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, I mean, that's or you may find, like, oh, well, I was wrong. I mean, that's how I ended up on an oval chain ring. Like, I wanted to ride one to say, yeah, I tried it and it still sucks, and thing's still on my bike.
Yeah.
So, yeah, man.
So I'll keep reporting back to you.
Yeah. The only thing I will say, and this, I mean, and honestly, anyone who's trying the Catalyst pedal, is I would say, like, you want to give it at least, like, 4 to 6 rides. Just on that pedal, 4 to 6 rides. And the other thing is the midfoot position. Like, something that's become clear to me as I've gotten into this is, like, the Catalyst isn't another flat pedal. It's the world's first midfoot optimized pedal.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I just happened to decide that a flat pedal was the best way to optimize the midfoot position because you want the pressure on both ends of the arch and that, you know what I mean? So, mm-hmm. like, for... So I chose a flat pedal because that's what was best for optimizing the midfoot position. Mm-hmm. I didn't make a flat pedal that was longer.
So this is, yeah, and this is also, and this is also a question that this links to what I do is, so my concern is I think my foot position will be the same on the Catalyst pedal as it is on my regular width pedals, would you say?
You'll end up moving them forward. Moving forward.
So then my only concern is that for a lot of my trials moves and sort of more of the jumpy, you know, some of that ankle movement is then diminished, right? So I don't have as much of that extra spring, like as if you're jumping from the ground, you leave kind of your toe last to create that extra hop. Certainly I'm nowhere near as like a clipless pedal position. Some of that ankle movement is advantageous for...
I'll be honest with you, I don't know. I'll be curious to hear what your... Because I find that manualing is easier
mm-hmm.
with these pedals. I feel like when I, like... Because, like, when I go to push in, like, my feet are so much more solid. So, like jumping and manualing and stuff.
Yeah.
I'm no world-class bunny hopper. So, I can't, you know... I haven't felt any difference in my bunny hops, you know, my freaking 12-inch bunny hops there. So I'm curious to hear what your take on it is going to be, because I don't know, you know what I mean? I honestly don't, you know, it could be a specialty thing. Like, yes, for that, for like a trials rider in this specialized situation, you know, this may be, you know, a better design for it. But I'm also kind of curious again, because I think like so much of the, you know, I mean, like how much are you know, the lift and all of that stuff, like, I don't know. Like, I feel like, you know, there might be a compensation between the increased efficiency of the foot and the increased pressure that you're able to create with the manual and the explosion out of that. Like, you know, you may find it wasn't so much the feet as you may have thought. And that's the other thing, too, is like, you know, you definitely lose some, but it's like, you know, your foot can still articulate. Sure. You know, it's not going to be able to articulate quite as much if it's there. But it's not like your heel can't drop or you can't, like, get this, like, you know, rolling motion, the same thing. So again, I'm really pumped that you're agreeing to try them out, because I am curious to hear what
I'll dive into your some take of these,
is with that.
I've got some curiosity, so
man, that'll be fun, man. But
did we address Natalie's question here?
You know, we haven't directly, but
did you read it there?
I did real quickly. Yeah, basically the practicing your track stands, which is awesome. And practice switch foot track stands. That's an important skill too. Riding switch foot, man, very underrated skill. Arches started cramping up.
That's not. I mean, track stands. Yeah, if you're practicing, yeah, that'll happen. I've done some, and that's actually, that could be something with your another endorsement for Kylos pedals.
I mean, because again, it's like if you just
what pedals were you using, Natalie? Does it say?
No, she had flat pedals.
Yeah.
But it's the, because again, like it goes back. It's basic engineering, right? Like an arch, it's one of the strongest forms in nature, as long as you support both ends.
Right.
Okay, you destabilize one end, the whole thing goes to shit.
Yeah.
Now, but your foot has to figure something out, right? Like your foot your foot still has to function. It can't go like, oh, one end's destabilized, I'm taking the rest of the day off.
Right.
It still has to function. So if you have one end stabilized by a pedal and the other end is kind of hanging in the air, guess what gets to stabilize the back of the arch, guys? Your muscles, the muscles of the arch of your foot, your calf and Achilles tendon. These muscles will statically contract to create the stability in the back half of the foot that you need for your foot to function.
Yeah.
That's why your feet cramp up. That's why people's feet get tired and crampy on rides. Like, that was one of the unintended side effects of the Catalyst pedal. It took me two or three rides, and I was like halfway through one of the rides, I'm like, dude, my pinky toe's not numb. And I can't remember the last time my pinky toe started to go numb. You know what I mean? Like, on long rides, sometimes I get a pinky toe going numb, or you get, like, some foot cramping, or you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it's just like, and I'm like, dude, my feet don't get tired. They don't cramp.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden I was like, oh, well, I'm supporting both ends of the foot. Like, it can relax. It doesn't have to, you know, and you were asking me about riding regular pedals. And I'm like, man, I can't. Like, you know, I can pedal around on them for a few minutes. But after about like 10 minutes, dude, my feet are so like, what are you doing? What are you doing to us right now?
Yeah.
It just feels so weird to try and support yourself just balancing on these little tiny platforms that, you know, once you get used to a big platform. But yeah, cool, all four track stand positions, awesome, Natalie. Yeah. So the Race Face Chesters are they're a really popular pedal because they're inexpensive and they get the job done, but they do have some of the drawbacks of a normal flat, which is that they're designed from the standpoint of pushing through the ball of the foot. Right, and so they're too small. They're just not big enough to support your foot properly, and so you're going to run into these issues, you know, like foot cramps and arch cramps and knee pain and stuff like that from the stuff over the long run. But so.
So one other question I had. So there's some pedals are being designed in that sort of that Convex,
yeah.
Instead of, and then there's flat, and then there's like concave. For me, I can't understand the theory of convex at all, because
their theory is the same. It's the foot gripping theory. It's that, well, yeah, if my foot's gonna wrap around the pedal and grip it, well, then I want to like give it something, you know, more for it to grip onto, to pull on. Like I've talked to some people that, you know, have done it before. I got into my pedal, you know, somebody sent me, I'm not going to say any names, but it's a very popular, pedal maker that has a convex shape to their extremely thin pedal. And it was one of the worst rides I've ever had in my life.
Yeah.
My foot arch was cramping like crazy. It didn't feel right.
And also anytime you lose pressure, anytime you lose pressure on your foot, all of a sudden now you've only got the mid pedal pins that you've got grip on.
Yeah.
And that happens on climbs. That happens in situations where all of a sudden one foot's going to be a little lighter on the pedal for some reason or another.
Well, but the theory is you got to pull up on the backstroke, right? So if you got to pull up on the backstroke, then I want to grip my pedal and I want to pull up with it. So that's what they're trying to do, is create a flat pedal that allows people to grab it with their feet so that they can pull up on the backstroke.
Yeah, it like prevents that.
Yeah, I mean, it's not a very smart, like, again, people assume, this is the funny thing, man. If you guys think that Trek and Shimano, I don't mean to talk trash about your sponsor, Shimano does great stuff.
Easy,
I know. I don't mean any, you know what I mean? I just mean, like, I think that the average rider out there has a misconception about who's on staff at a lot of companies. These people do not employ exercise physiologists. They do not employ biomechanical engineers. They do not employ, you know what I mean? Like a lot of these companies are not, you know, like these are not the guys who come up with these ideas. And then these aren't the guys who they're running them through. Like they're not, they don't have guys like Gray Cook and Mike Boyle and you know, like these top coaches and movement experts and stuff like that, that they're consulting with these things. These are people who have they come up with a theory, and the theories are usually based on the usual ways of looking at stuff in the cycling industry, which is I got to push through the ball on my foot and I got to pull up on the backstroke. We were talking about this earlier. Like that's the thing. And if you start, like, I have to design a pedal that I can push through the ball of my foot and I can pull up on my backstroke, it leads to certain design things that you're going to do, without ever stepping back and questioning, like, well, do we want to do this in the first place? And is this really biomechanically sound? Does this violate movement principles?
Yeah.
You know, and a lot of the times, man, these questions are not being asked, and that's not what's going on at the highest levels at these cycling companies. When I say this stuff, it's not they're evil. It's more like, look, man, we just need to be honest and know what's going on so that you guys, if you're assuming that people are designing these convex pedals from some biomechanical engineering place with a movement principle-based standpoint and there's scientific principles behind it, you're wrong. That's not what's happening at all. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So so anyways, the same thing with the concave shape. Like that's – You want a concave shape because, again, if you need to push through the ball of your foot, then you want to be on the ball of your foot. And if you put a little rounding so the ball of your foot can now fit into that rounding, well, now it's going to keep my foot from going forward, and it's going to give me a little bit to pull up with on the back. But I have to be on the ball of the foot for that to work. You know what I mean? As soon as I go more midfoot, that shape actually starts to work work against me, because now the middle of the pedal is actually pushed away from my foot. So if I go midfoot on a concave pedal, the middle of my foot has less contact with the middle of the pedal.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah.
So it actually works against how like your foot wants to work, and it takes away your option for foot position, right? Because if it's designed to be on the ball of your foot, then you go to a more midfoot position. Well, it's not designed for that. You know what I mean? Now, like I said, now you don't have pressure here, like you were saying, you know, with the convex. You change your foot or you get in a different situation, and now all of a sudden it doesn't work as effectively because that's not what it was designed for.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, man, that's a lot of the pedal stuff on the market. Like that's why I try to differentiate with people. Like, you know, the Catalyst isn't another pedal. It's the world's first midfoot optimized pedal. It's not, you can't try and figure out what it feels like based on your experience on a regular pedal, because they're two completely different things. Like, this is designed from a ball of the foot theory. You know, this is designed from a midfoot theory. And so the experience on them is going to be different, you know, so, because of that.
So yeah, there we got, it's always a conversation with James isn't complete until you can see there's passion based on his research and his, you know, that your position on flat pedals and your pedal. I mean, it's cool because you, I can tell it can't be faked. I mean, you really truly believe in what you've created for good reason. And so,
yeah,
which is cool. Any other questions here? I think we've addressed most of the questions, but if anyone is still tuning in here, please just fire a question in the comments about sort of anything to do with, you know, especially cross training with flat pedals, with techniques, with any issues you've got with kind of your body or your posture. I mean, that's definitely James's specialty. But I did have actually one question. I was curious for bunny hopping. You know, sort of the standard shoulder raise versus sort of some of the more pulling sort of exercises, and it seems to me that sort of the shoulder raise, that movement is actually really important for the bunny hop versus just the pulling in sort of
well. So that's why I like the kettlebell swing. And honestly, this is kind of funny. Like, I'll be first to say it here, but like, I'm actually starting to have real doubts about the usefulness of the kettlebell swing. I think it's actually kind of an awkward movement that doesn't fit into like real movement patterns. So I've been focusing more on like just clean and presses with my kettlebell and doing more swings with the Indian clubs.
Yeah,
because the Indian clubs allow me to take a narrow stance. It's a more natural movement, but the idea that the swing, when you do a swing, your arms are relaxed. Like, I'm raising my arms because I'm projecting energy into the kettlebell or the Indian club, whatever I'm holding, right? But I'm projecting energy into it, and that's making it raise. But the energy isn't coming from my arms. The energy is being projected from my hips through my arms into what I'm raising. And so that's why I like that exercise for the bunny hopping and manualing movement more than like a front raise, because a front raise is teaching you how to generate that energy from your arms themselves. Mm-hmm. And so that ability to kind of keep them relaxed and let them like whip, you know, act as that transfer of energy, as opposed to the creator of the energy, I've just personally found to be like, you know, an important thing, because your arms, as soon as you try to lift with your arms, like, my whole theory with riding a bike is like, all of your movement should originate, it's like a general rule, right? Mm-hmm. That most of your movement should generate from your hips. So your hips need to be driving the movements, because you got this dance, right? It's like your bike's center of gravity and your center of gravity. And that's the dance.
Sure.
Right? That's the dance. That's it. That's all. Riding a bike can be boiled down to that. Bike center of gravity, my center of gravity, and it's a dance.
Yeah.
And, you know, wherever it is affects it. Wherever this is affects this, right? So, like, if I move me, right, if I move my arms and that moves my bike, but it didn't move my center of gravity, I'm unbalanced. Mm-hmm. If I move my center of gravity and that projects into the bike center of gravity, we stay balanced. Mm-hmm. So for me, like, getting people away from using their arms and understanding how to use their hips to generate the movement is really important. And just for the record, if your hips aren't moving, they can't be generating the movement. I just want to say, like, I've seen a training tool coming on the market that's supposed to help your pumping skills, and I see a lot of arm movement going on with it, and not the hips
Okay.
moving. and you know, they can claim that oh no, this is helping you learn how to use your hips, but movement 101 is, if your hips aren't moving, they can't be driving the movement. Like, you have to be moving to be creating the movement. Mm-hmm. So like, if you see someone on a bike and they're just doing this, mm-hmm. and their hips are staying kind of static in space, mm-hmm. they're just using their arms.
Right.
Yeah. Right. If you see the hips moving, right, the hips move forward, the hips move back.
It's pretty, and the hip, yeah, it is pretty huge.
Yeah. Like, and that's what's moving the arms.
Yeah. And being able to, yeah, to be able to move the hips in a way where they can actually go through quite a range of motion, rearward, forward, momentarily, and still manage to maintain control over the bike. But it's gotta come back to that centered, balanced place. But man, being able to manipulate your hips for a lot of technical skills, forward, back, and that's, for instance, when you're riding up a technical section of trail and you see a ledge coming and you gotta get to the top of the ledge. I mean, that's basically where you gotta as you approach, you gotta get your hips up high and forward really quickly, so then you can extend the rest of the bike so the rear tire gets back up the ledge, and then the hips are going to be far behind once you get it up, and then you got to quickly bring the hips back to center afterwards. So there's that dance, and the more comfortable you can be on the bike with your hips in these extreme positions, man, the more it really becomes like a tool. I think I once used an ice axing as a bit of a terminology in one of the drivetrain skills that I taught on the site, which is like you ice axe and pull yourself up,
push it, the microphone there. No, again, man, I think that's one of the big things, like, people don't understand, like, you have to separate yourself from the bike too.
Yeah, right?
So what you're talking about is, like, when you come to a ledge, you know, instead of just like bashing into that ledge, like you're talking about bunny hopping, mm-hmm. you know, and you bunny hop on every trail, even though you may not necessarily have to. Well, it's like, man, every trail, like, even if it's not a bunny hop, man, instead of just like, you know, running into that rock and letting your suspension take it, like, there should be a subtle little weight shift back to unweight the front, and then weight shift back again to unweight the rear, because that little bit of unweighting, it increases your efficiency, you know, and you lose less speed doing that. And so that whole dance of like learning how to move your hips forward and backward, and, you know, same thing with cornering, man. Like, probably the best advice I ever got from cornering was from my father-in-law, who's a surfer.
Oh yeah.
And he was talking about how, like, people think you turn your surfboard with your hips, and he's like, they're wrong. And I'm like, well, this would be interesting. I'm like, what do you turn them with? And he's like, it's your shoulders. He's like, your shoulders turn, and then your hips turn, and then your feet turn, and then your board turn. And I'm like,
yeah,
that motherfucker's right.
Yeah. And yeah, it's the same with, yeah, absolutely.
And so same thing cornering. I went out and for the longest time I'm trying to, like, just turn my hips, mm-hmm. right? Like, cause I'm wanting to, like, you know, lean my bike and turn my hips, and my upper body is basically dead. You know, my shoulders are dead because we're told don't lean your body.
Yeah.
Lean the bike, not your body. And
that's dangerous. There's so many teaching cues that are so dangerous when they get stuck in.
And so, but yeah, it was like learning how to, like, get that shoulder, and then it's like, okay, well, the shoulder dips, but the thing that I found is, like, that ability to corkscrew the hips, like, your hips have to be able to move off your center line and stay balanced though. And, like, most people don't know how to do that. And so what they end up doing is they end up leaning in. So, like, they go to lean, right? And so, right? So I'm here on my bike and I'm going, and it's like, what I want to be able to do is I can shift my hips and see how my shoulders kind of stay centered. I'm balanced, right? Yeah. So now I can lean my body and I'm still balanced. But what happens is, if you don't have this corkscrewing motion down, you do this. You know what I mean? It's like, it's unbalanced. It's like I lean inside of my balance point. And that's what leads to people washing out, hitting the deck, and crashing. And then that's what leads to coaches who don't know any better saying, well, don't lean your body.
Right.
You know, lean your bike. If you lean your bike and you stay here, like, you can't fall over.
Right, yeah.
So, anyways, but yeah, man. So, it's just that little dance with the hips. But same thing with the arms, you know, just kind of getting that – using the hips, the power of the arms.
question from Carl Rowe, who, for those that don't know, he manages the coach and ambassador team for the RLC membership site. So thanks for all your work there, Carl. And he's got a question for James on the idea of the light hands, heavy feet. And so he's noticed you don't follow that. So anyone who's reading, do you want to address that question?
Yeah. Well, what he's saying, so he doesn't follow light hand, heavy feet. And I talk about applying hand pressure instead. He's asking, he's discovered that bending the bars, which is basically like grabbing the bars and like, you know, feeling like you're trying to pull them apart or like, you know, bend them together. But like, you know, there's definitely pressure there with that. When he corners and manuals, helps to lock in his shoulders. Exactly, man. You know, like I was talking about, like your grip strength and your shoulders are intimately connected. So like when you grip hard, there are times when like gripping hard, like when you manual, you know, you're going to have to grip hard at the handlebars because that's going to reflexively tighten up your shoulders and protect your shoulders. And so that idea of doing that, it says, is really helping. It provides better feedback for the trail. Really helps my cornering by applying inside bar pressure. Is this good technique, or is there a better way to lock the shoulders in? A bad habit of packing my shoulders. The bending the bars is good. Like really that pressurized, you know, I got an article called "Are We Misapplying Light Hands, Heavy Feet?" And it basically comes from, again, like these kind of these general pieces of advice that are given to new riders a lot, which is, you know, you want to have as much weight as possible on your feet and real light hands. And what that generally comes from is like new riders tend to death grip their bars. Mm-hmm. So we don't want that. We don't want that. Or they tend to lean into their bars. They're using their bars to help support their upper body, and we don't want that.
Yeah.
So we tell them light hands, because if you've got light hands, well, you're not death gripping the bar and you're not leaning into the bar. But then people get afraid to put any weight at all or grip the bars tightly ever on the bike. And so they try to learn how to ride their bike in this really unnatural way of keeping a bunch of weight and pressure on their feet with as little weight and pressure on their hands as possible. Mm-hmm. And your hands are just like your feet. Like we were talking about earlier about how your feet have feedback, have pressure sensors and nerves in them that your brain uses for feedback. And so like, for example, when the back of your heel isn't supported, it can tell that and you can't use your hips as effectively. It changes how your body moves, all this stuff. Mm-hmm. Same thing with your hands. Your hands have pressure sensors and stuff in them as well. And so what you're looking for is you want to feel that handlebar across this line. And this line right here, when you've got pressure in there, that's your brain, you know, that's what it's using for feedback. That's, you know, you're hitting all those pressure sensors and stuff like that. And so when you're really light and you got no pressure on your hands, your brain has no feedback to be strong and tight in the shoulders.
Yeah.
Right. And so, but when you have some pressure and some strength in your hands, it does. And so the idea is to keep that pressure across that palm. If you've ever done kettlebell lifting, they'll talk about this is where you want to hold your kettlebell, right across this diagonal line. And it's the same thing. These little pressure points, you know, especially here, that help activate the long head of the tricep, which the long head of the tricep crosses the elbow and the shoulder. So it helps to secure the shoulder joint. And so if it's not activated properly, it's not going to be able to help secure the shoulder joint like it should. And so, you know, that pressure right there will really help with that, the shoulder stuff. So, but you want to keep that pressure. I guess like as long as in bending the bars, you don't feel like the pressure on the inside start to peel up off of your hands, you know. So you want to feel that pressure across. In fact, that hand pressure is a good indicator of elbow position, because if my elbows get too far out wide, which is a big problem, gets too far out wide, you'll feel the inside, this little thing, start to peel up off your handlebars. You'll lose pressure on the inside of your hand. If your elbows are too far in, the inside of your hand will start to peel up and you'll lose pressure. If you have good, even pressure across this point right here, I guarantee your elbows are in a good spot.
Cool. Yeah, that's
yeah, and it'll help too with the shoulders and all that stuff. So yeah, for sure.
Yeah, there's a certain kind of easefulness that your body needs to have as well, and sort of the light hands thing might be trying to speak to that, but but I tend to find that, you know, when I'm out on a ride, I'm always yeah, trying to feel fluid but connected in my whole body. So my whole body is loose, but at the same time it's connected. So there's not the death grip. There's not the rigid hips only in one little sort of column. There's this movement and this kind of fluidity that the body needs to have to allow, you know, there's so much that goes on with your body during a ride that you can't force. And the fluidity of your body, you've got your, you know, you've got just the right amount of grip strength, you know, you've got your feet that are alive on the pedals, and then all this movement and spontaneous adjustment to the terrain happens far more easily when you're relaxed. So there's kind of this relaxed but ready kind of position.
Yeah, yeah. And again, going back to the, you know, the swings, you know, that's one of the good skills that the swing teaches you, is that it's to be able to relax your grip and then get it tight, and then relax it and get it tight. And it's cool. that relaxation and tightening, which again, that's a skill that you have to learn.
And that happens during the ride constantly.
That's what you want.
There's not just one grip pressure.
It's not just not just tight, and it's not just relaxed. Yeah. There's a gripping. There's as relaxed as I need it until I need it to be tight, and then as relaxed as I need it. And so it's that, you know, that's what you want. And I think, like, you know, a lot of times people try to look for that one answer, you know, and so I always want to have my hips in this one position. I always want to have my hands in this one position. I always want to have my elbows out in this position. I always want to look like I'm in this position. And if I look like I'm in this position, then I'm going to look like I know what I'm doing. And so anyways, that's the difference, man, is that's the difference between learning how to actually execute a skill versus like kind of looking like you're just acting that skill out. And unfortunately, I do, again, I've talked about why I admire what you do, but, you know, someone who respects and teaches movement like you do, like, you're actually teaching people how to execute the skill. And a lot of the stuff I see out there that, you know, from a lot of other skill stuff is really just trying to teach people how to act like they look like they know how to execute the skill. Mm. And it's not the same thing, you know. You get these parking lot and pump track tricks that help people kind of feel like they're riding better in a park, you know, that weekend. And then you catch up to them a month later and you're like, man, you're riding the exact same way. Like, there's nothing really fundamentally different about how you're riding, you know. And it's like, well, I remember, you know, 3 points of the 10 points of cornering or whatever. And it's like, well, that, you know what I mean? And it's like, if you really fundamentally change how you move and how you understand how you move, again, going back to like yoga and having a mindful movement practice, something that you can apply to the bike.
Totally.
Like, those are the things that are going to lead to that long-term progress that you're really looking for. But so,
do you have any questions for me at all before we wrap up this conversation?
Man, no. I mean, you know, the jumping thing was good. I mean, I do. Unfortunately, I gotta get running here to my little girl's volleyball game here in a minute.
Yeah.
But I want to pick your brain on your thoughts on cornering and stuff a little bit.
I've got a lot there.
Yeah. It seems like we're kind of on the same page with that. It's interesting how we're both, like, you know, there are these kind of you know, rules. Like, you know, I once did a thing, right? I did a seminar, like the top three skills training myths, and they were like light hands, heavy feet, lean your body, not your bike, and elbows out. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And, like, you know, those are three things. Those are really three common myths, like skills training advice. You'll hear almost everywhere people give that advice: elbows out, light hands, heavy feet, and
lean your bike.
Yeah, and lean the bike, not your body. Yeah. And it's funny, like, you're like one of the few people that when I talk to and I say, like, you know, I throw out like why that's BS, and you're just like, exactly.
Yeah. I mean, that was why the cornering continuum is such a, it's a big course, because there's just so many different things going on. And as soon as you kind of, your brain locks on to a few rules, then it prevents the opportunity to really experience and learn what every corner can teach you. And so the course just systematically goes through all the continuums of how your bike and body can be based on all the different continuums of corner types, and blending those two together into this dance, and not setting any rules. And, you know, that's the challenging thing. People like rules. They like, do this, and you got it. Or like, you know, these, you know, quick fixes for learning something is just,
there's no quick fix, man. No quick fix. So, no. Well, cool, dude. Yeah, no, we'll dig into that in the next podcast or interview we'll do. So, yeah, man, this was fun for sure.
And thanks for everyone tuning in this Facebook group. It's just such a beautiful group of people with open minds and curiosity about how to ride bikes. And I think it's just a great culture to be involved in. And I'm really glad to have you sharing your voice here in
this community. Yeah, my pleasure.
And I always love chatting. I mean, we were chatting for over an hour again. Boom, boom, boom. We can just – we had – barely scratched the surface.
I know, man. If I didn't have to go to the volleyball game, we'd be here all afternoon. So heck yeah, man.
Cool.
Well, cool, brother.
Thanks, James.
Yeah, man. Yeah, appreciate you guys having me on. We'll do it again.
Cool. See you guys.
See ya. Sweet.
Cool.
All right, man.
Nice. So that seemed to go all right, I think.
Yeah, no, that was good, man. That was fun.
Yeah.
Appreciate the